Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument, Jonitas versus Exelon, Mr. Sneckenberg.
Please the court. Good morning. My name is Bill Sneckenberg. I represent the plaintiff class who filed an FLSA case and comparable state wage loss claims, which was a subject matter of a decision by Judge Kaur, which granted summary judgment on the claims in favor of Commonwealth Edison. The claims that are at issue before this court.
Could I just ask you something right off the bat?
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Would a decision in this case put the court in the position of interpreting the CBA?
I believe he believed he was interpreting portions of the CBA, yes. However, there is no definition in the CBA as to what compensable work is. And so he could not interpret what that term meant in relationship to the FLSA claims.
So we would not be interpreting the CBA.
You needed to interpret it so far as to see if there is a definition of compensable work within the CBA that would override the overriding concerns of the FLSA. The issues, as I see it, are the mealtime claims, the overtime claims relating to call-outs, and the Section 301 preclusion.
It's not about this being a class action, though. Isn't the situation of these workers very heterogeneous?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. There's nothing in this record.
Some of them are called, say, on the issue about the callbacks, some of them are called back frequently, some very rarely. So how can they both be in the same class?
They're still subject to the same general policy.
No, but suppose you have someone who's never called back. How's he doesn't have an FLSA claim.
Well, I don't think that there's any record that ever happened, to be honest with you. But hypothetically,
well, suppose you call back once a month. You're going to say that is a violation of FLSA?
No, because on the callbacks, the
okay, so some of the people in your class don't have a claim.
I believe that I can't say that for a fact. I know that the class consists of people who are called out, and the average call out is greater than.
Yes, but an average is consistent with enormous variance, right?
I would agree.
So suppose you have some people who are in your class who are either never called back or they just call back once a month. They don't belong in a class. They're not entitled to any relief.
They would not have been detrimentally affected by the on-call policy.
Right, and yet they're
true.
Part of your class.
It was certified as a.
Well,
basis.
I don't think that's proper. Remember, a class action is one in which the common issues predominate over the individual issues. And in this case, it looks like every one of your class members would have different evidence concerning number of callbacks, how much it disrupts his life, and so on.
I would say that 70% to 90% of the callback class is relating to construction and maintenance workers. So to that extent, those people have a class status.
It's sort of a kind of a follow-up. How frequently did employees receive calls on weekends? And given the low required acceptance rate, how many weekends were impacted on average, if you can answer that?
The weekends, the majority, according to the record, of the callbacks occur on weekends. And the callbacks range depending upon certain classifications within the organizational structure of ComEd. They can go from 6 to 18 at any given any given month, but the majority of those are callbacks on weekends. And the problem that exists with respect to that is that the employees are working harder than they used to work with respect to the 40-hour day because of the reduction in the wage force.
Let me ask you a question about the defining what's working in this situation. And on a traditional job that we think of when we think of a Fair Labor Standard Act case, it's one where, for instance, you work for a brewery, and as I did at Miller Brewery in Milwaukee, and while you're working there, you have a certain time. And you worked third shift, it was 4 a.m. to 4:30 a.m. That was your lunch period, and you did that every day. Here, the definition of what is working time and what is not is sort of fluid. And if that is true, why isn't that something that's best left to arbitration under a collective bargaining agreement, a grievance procedure, if you think that you're being mistreated somehow?
Well, it's not as fluid as Your Honor would think. Like I said, the construction and maintenance workers, 70 to 90% of those folks work the 7 to 3:30 shift and are provided a half-hour lunch hour, unpaid. So the majority of the FLSA class, the vast majority, are subject to that time frame. And it's no question in my mind that we have a dispute between ComEd and the plaintiffs over the kind of activities they perform at their lunchtime.
Yes, but that's another example of the lack of homogeneity of the class, because some of these people aren't doing anything except eating lunch, right?
No, I don't. I disagree, Your Honor.
All of them, or I didn't.
For example,
you make a point of, well, when they're told to drop their tools, and then you say, well, that's a situation in which they're have a lot of responsibility during the lunch to watch the equipment. But they're not always. That's not always the situation. So some of the people in your class may not have encountered a drop the tools situation, right?
Theoretically, you're right.
Why do you say theoretically?
Because
what does the record show?
Because there is a policy that these folks that are on the streets, that are in the construction and maintenance employees, that their policy is to safeguard and protect the site. And that policy applies across the board to every employee.
But that's a separate issue. So you have the drop the tools situation, then you have the normal situation. And those are different, right? And we might decide, well, drop the tools has one legal standing, and the other normal lunch situation doesn't. And then you, right?
In this record, I haven't seen any of this other than drop the tools people. But if there is, it's a subset. The majority, an overwhelming majority, of the maintenance and construction workers drop tools pursuant to company policy and safeguard and protect the site of where they're working.
What does safeguarding the site mean? Does it mean they're just... I know they're not allowed to sleep. So does that mean they just keep their eyes open to make sure, you know, no one falls in a hole or something? Or are they patrolling or walking around or something, eating while walking, something like that?
It's probably a combination. In the winter, I wouldn't expect them to be walking out in our weather conditions here in Chicago, but the evidence is that they sit in their trucks, they eat their lunch, and they make sure people aren't going to walk into open manholes.
Well, if you're sitting in your truck eating lunch and just looking out the window, is that working?
Absolutely. It's no different than the working of under the regulations, the Department of Labor regulations, where somebody is
goes home and he thinks about his job and how he's going to do it better tomorrow. Is that working?
I think when you have an obligation.
Well, is that working?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you restate that?
Yeah, if one of these workers goes home at night and he thinks about his job and he thinks about how he can do it better, you know, he's thinking some construction, some change in how he works, He's thinking about the equipment, how he can maintain it better. Is he working when he's thinking?
I believe he is.
Wait a second. You mean he can file a suit under the FLSA because he says, when I go home at night, I'm preoccupied with my job, and I think about how I can do it better?
No. He's actually performing on the job for that half-hour period, protecting the site per his employer's requirements.
Was there evidence regarding the nature of the security duties during lunch, the frequency of interruptions, let's say, the extent to which the employers are required to remain at a set location? Was there evidence as to all of that?
Some of that, yes. There's evidence that they're required to maintain the site so tools aren't taken. They're required to drop tools so that the site is not finished. They have to make sure that that site isn't affected by the public. They have to make sure that people don't get walk into the site. Contractors don't come by the site and potentially interfere with what's being done. Those are all obligations that they have.
But doesn't that mean that every person who eats lunch at his desk or in the office is working, right? So if an office worker is working at his desk, is eating lunch at his desk, it means, you know, he's looking around at the workplace, the office, make sure no one comes in who doesn't belong there, answers the phone, so on. So I'm wondering about the scope of your submission.
Well, the scope is limited to what the security and safety concerns are on a work site in the Chicago area.
Well, you can't limit the principle of the case that narrowly. Limit it to Chicago?
No.
So people who do this in another city, do the same things, are not protected by the FLSA?
Absolutely not.
So why do you mention Chicago?
Because that's where this case arises.
No, look, the principle you're advocating is nationwide. It's not limited to Chicago.
The principle I'm advocating is the same.
For every worker who during lunch is doing something on behalf of his employer, isn't it?
No.
No?
No.
Why not?
Because their employer isn't requiring that they do certain things at lunch other than eat their lunch. If they want to eat lunch or go off the premises.
What if they're required to answer the phone?
May or may not be. That's de minimis.
What does that mean, may or may not be?
I don't know what the rule is. It's a hypothetical that doesn't involve this particular situation.
Well, I think every employer expects his employees, if they're in the office, even if they're eating lunch, if the phone rings, to answer the phone.
I can't equate answering a phone, with all due respect.
Why not?
With what these people do on the street.
You don't know what they do. They're just sitting, according to you, they're sitting in the truck.
That's not true, Your Honor.
What are they doing when they're sitting in the truck and eating?
They're watching the sites, securing the site.
Their eyes somewhere. How are they securing the site when they're sitting in a truck? How is that securing a site?
During the period of time they're there, they could be walking around the site.
But they're supposed to just sitting in the truck.
I'm not saying they sit in the truck 24/7, 12 months out of the year.
Well, obviously they don't. The question is what they're doing when they're eating lunch.
What they're doing is what they're required to do, and that's make sure that things are safe.
Munching, right?
No, the things are safe.
Well, they're just sitting in a truck and looking to make sure no one runs on the property, right?
And that could be safety-related, absolutely.
How's that working?
Somebody walks into the site, you get out of your truck and you say, leave.
Keep your eyes open.
It is to be alert.
To be alert is working?
When you have a site where electricity is involved, yes. And I'll say this to Your Honor, the Wright case, which is a telephone employee case. They held, based upon almost the same set of circumstances that exist here, that those telephone employees who were out on the road and safeguarding and protecting and securing a site were entitled to pay during that period of time. And that is a case that's somewhere on the West Coast. But this policy of applying an obligation on your employees out in the workplace, which are dealing with sometimes very dangerous situations, to maintain and protect the site, whether it be in the truck or walking around, is something that's outside of what the FLSA requires from an arbitration standpoint.
Why wouldn't that be a better subject then for collective bargaining, for the union to say, we believe we're entitled to more compensation during this period of time than you're giving us, and if they can't come to an agreement, then you you strike or you do something like that.
That's what the Leahy opinion stands for, but there is no indication in this collective bargaining agreement of any such agreement. And without that, it has to be left to the courts.
I agree that that's what Leahy, that my example is drawn from Leahy, but in a situation where it's so hard to define what is working and what is not working, as Judge Posner's questions, I think, bring out here, it's difficult to say this is working or this isn't working. I don't know. It might be working. It might not be. But when it's something that's imprecise like that, why isn't the collective bargaining grievance, labor management fight over the issue the way to resolve it?
Because the Supreme Court said the courts are to deal with those issues, that arbitrators know the rules of the shop, but they're not as knowledgeable about the rule of law.
Well, I can guarantee you that the people involved in arbitration on an issue like this will know a lot more about it than judges sitting here know about what goes on guarding a site or things like that.
Aren't the labor arbitrators usually lawyers?
I think probably the majority of them probably are.
Now, what is it in the Supreme Court's Wright case that you rely on? It's unclear.
We rely on it simply from the standpoint that in the Supreme Court ruled that waiver to a certain extent.
It's not the facts. It's not a factually similar case.
No.
Oh, okay. Your time has expired. Thank you. Mr. Montgomery?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to begin by just following up on some of the questions that I heard from the panel. And I think that some of the questions as to what is work, and I think that's some of the difficulty here, I'd like to direct the Court back to what this Court talked about in Leahy, in particular where the Court went back to Tennessee Coal versus Muskoda. Because I think that difficulty was addressed in Tennessee Coal versus Muskoda. And in particular, in Tennessee versus Coal versus Muskoda, the court noted that employers and employees may make reasonable provisions of contract or custom governing the computation of work hours where precisely accurate computation is difficult or impossible. And I think that that's very key here. And I think that's what you had in Leahy, and I think that's what happened here.
Well, I'd like to ask you something about Leahy.
Sure.
Although Leahy declared that the CBA precluded the FLSA claim if the arbitrator subsequently interpreted the CBA as defining work contrary to the FLSA, wouldn't the petitioner then be able to proceed with an FLSA claim in light of Barentine?
If I understand your question, I think what you're saying is that the case goes to arbitration. The arbitrator rules, and there's some question about whether or not the ruling, if you will, comports with the Fair Labor Standards Act. And I think that the answer is yes. So, for example, if the arbitrator, for example, ruled, and let's take Barentine. And Barentine is a situation where you had the employer there that basically excluded an entire category of work from ever being compensable, no matter what the circumstances were.
Well,
okay? So in that situation, I think that obviously the contract was clear, just like an arbitrator's ruling would be, and therefore one could argue that, look, this doesn't comport with the Fair Labor Standards Act. Does that answer your question?
To me, what I think, is that in Barentine, the Supreme Court held that FLSA rights are independent of the collective bargaining agreement and they're not waivable, so that the court determined that the rights are best protected in a judicial rather than arbitral forum, and that petitioners were not barred from bringing their claims in federal court, even if the arbitrator had ruled against them.
That's true. However, keep in mind the scope of Barentine. Barentine did not involve, and it's very clear, Barentine did not involve the need to interpret the collective bargaining agreement. And that, I think that's absolutely critical here. Again, what they did in Barentine is that they took an entire category of work, this pre-inspection work that was involved in Barentine, and they said that no matter what the circumstances were, it was going to be compensable. There wasn't any dispute by the parties as to what that meant. There wasn't any lack of clarity in the contract.
Yeah, but
that's
you're
what's
not
fundamentally
arguing,
different.
Are you, that the arbitrator can violate the Fair Labor Standard? I thought your argument is that there's this gray area where, you know, it's very unclear, very fact-specific, so we'll let the arbitrator decide it rather than a court. But the arbitrator has to, he can't flout the Fair Labor Standards Act. Isn't that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. But
inconsistent with the FLSA, right? You can't have a collective bargaining agreement that says we agree to accept subminimum wage or something, right?
Exactly, because that's then not protecting the, you know, the minimum protections, if you will, of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So I would agree with that. But
was
what
the FLSA argued to the arbitrator?
No, absolutely not. The arbitrator's authority is wholly limited by the contract.
But the union didn't say, you know, to the arbitrator, you have to interpret it this way or else you'd be violating the act, something of that sort.
Hypothetically, if we actually had a grievance here, am I understanding your question correctly?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the union, I don't think, I mean, I suppose they could argue anything that you want, but I believe that the contract, no matter what, is absolutely strict in limiting the arbitrator's role and authority to interpreting the contract. And in this particular case, I think it comes down to the question of what is work. And, of course, going back to Tennessee Coal versus Muskoda, that case allows, and subsequent Quake cases allow, the parties to determine what is and what is not work, provided that it comports with the Fair Labor Standards Act, and, of course, provided that any contract or custom is reasonable. And I think that Tennessee Coal was somewhat narrow, as with Leahy, and it was really talking about those limited circumstances where you have actually difficulty in terms of having any precision and accuracy as to what is work. So in this case,
bottom line, are you arguing that the employees are not required to remain at the job site for safety reasons?
What we are arguing...
Isn't there at least a dispute of fact on that issue?
If I can, I have to address that in a few parts, okay? So please forgive me.
Seems like such a simple question.
I know. The lunch guidelines clearly say that they have no such obligations, okay? The lunch guidelines that are based on past practice, although they dispute, obviously, that past practice is being followed, which is, I think, inherently an arbitrable issue, the lunch guidelines say that they're completely relieved from duty, okay, and that they're free to leave their post. So the answer is no. They, of course, if you look at the record, you will look and you'll say that, well, you know, one person will say, I think that I've got this duty to secure the site, but you know, gee, nobody in management specifically told me, but I always thought that was my obligation. So there's no pinpointing of anything where you have anybody that really definitively says that I was directed to do this. But having said that, though, I think that that then goes back into the Leahy issue a little bit. Because the difficulty here, Judge Robner, is that if you talk about guarding or securing the site, what does that mean? So does it mean, for example, that if the employees, let's say they're sitting there, they're reading a book, they're eating a sandwich, and then all of a sudden there's a cone that blows over, okay, a little wind gust, and then they then go up and it takes them 30 seconds to put the cone back up, does that make the entire 30-minute meal period work?
Yes.
You know, or does it take something longer? And I think the whole point of Tennessee Coal versus Muskoda and this court's decision in Leahy is that when you have this disparity, if you will, in all these situations, when it's difficult, when you have employees that are unsupervised at a site, how do you compute that? How with any precision and accuracy do you do that, and therefore...
With evidence. It's, what I'm worried about is that there isn't enough evidence here.
Oh, well, but that would be... There hasn't been the arbitration yet, right?
It hasn't been to arbitration, and the employees...
Now, when you have the, you know, if you win and the case goes to arbitration, the evidence is introduced and so on, will it be open to will it be open to the union to argue that as a matter of FLSA law, if they're working more than, you know, 5 minutes during the 30 minutes or something like that, the whole 30 minutes has to count as work? Can they make that argument to the arbitrator? Well, the arbitrator said, well, that's, you know, law. I don't do that. I just interpret the collective bargaining agreement.
I think that's correct. I think the union could make that argument that you should follow the Fair Labor Standards Act. However, the arbitrator very well say, look, my authority is controlled by the contract. And of course the
how can a contract preempt the Fair Labor Standards Act, right?
Well, because, again, I think that then goes back, you know, to several decisions, if you will, that when you – anytime this court is asked to interpret a contract –
there's a difference between saying that as a matter of kind of choice of form or something like that, the arbitrator – back to Judge Rovner's question – that the arbitrator is in a better position to make the relevant factual determinations than a judge is. So that's fine. But that doesn't – imply that the arbitrator can say, well, actually, you know, having found the facts, I think this is work under the FLSA, but I'm just interpreting a collective bargaining agreement, doesn't incorporate the Fair Labor Standards Act, so I'm going to ignore that. Wouldn't that be a serious problem?
I don't believe so at all.
Really?
No.
Well, that's a Barentine, isn't it?
No, absolutely not.
How can the arbitrator just say, well, you know, this violates the Fair Labor Standards Act, but I just enforce the collective bargaining agreement?
I think that again, if I can go back, I think that what the arbitrator's role is confined within the contract, and of course, Barentine.
I think you're hurting yourself, right?
Yeah.
I think you're hurting yourself because it's one thing to say, well, let's have the arbitrator decide this. He's in a better position than the judge. And certainly what's in the collective bargaining agreement is relevant. And if you're in this gray area where we don't really know what the Fair Labor Standards Act requires, then this is sort of the common sense of a case like Leahy. We'll let the arbitrator, you know, exercise discretion. But there's a difference between exercising discretion in a gray area and saying, well, look, I just look at the contract, and I know this violates the Fair Labor Standards Act, but that's not my business. And if you permit that, then you have just an unenforced Fair Labor Standards Act.
But
it can't be right.
The problem I'm having, Judge Posner, and I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be difficult here, is that, again, I think what the arbitrator is doing is looking at what any custom
doing,
practices
but you can't have a kind of legal vacuum here where an arbitrator is permitted to say, well, I know, you know, this violates the Fair Labor Standards Act. What do I care? I'm just an arbitrator. I just interpret contracts.
But doesn't the arbitrator decide, is it working or is it not working?
Absolutely. Absolutely, and that's what the arbitrator's role is.
If it's not working, then it's not going to violate the Fair Labor Standards Act. But I don't think he can say, well, actually, it's working, but as I read the contract, that doesn't matter. You're not entitled to your wage.
He couldn't say that.
Right. He couldn't say that because that wouldn't, again, comport with the Fair Labor Standards Act. So, and again, I think if you look at this particular contract.
The Fair Labor Standards. So you're saying not allowed to violate the Fair Labor Standards, but he can decide whether it's work.
Sure.
And then
It seems to me that neither the collective bargaining agreement itself nor the arbitrator's decision can preclude a plaintiff from seeking a court determination of whether the interpretation complied with the FLSA.
But, again, I think that in preclusion decisions in this court, again, I refer back to Brown and to Tice or even the Third Circuit decision in the Vedino case. That's a Fair Labor Standards Act case, Judge Rovin.
I think we
Judge
should
Rovin.
Stick with, you know, Leahy, Barentine, and I'm sorry. I can't think of a third case.
No, and I agree with you. We certainly have a lot here. That's certainly true. But again, I think that, you know, the cases I was referring to was in absolute harmony with Leahy. Because again, what you have here is a situation where, you know, it's the case is going to require some contract interpretation to determine what is work.
Sitting
and
here,
once
I'm
you
not
do
sure
that,
Leahy comports with anything.
Well, I think you're saying work means the same thing in the collective bargaining agreement and the Fair Labor Standards Act, aren't you?
I'm saying that work...
Because what if the collective bargaining agreement said, well, the only time you're working is when you're sweating. You're not sweating. We don't call that work. Now, that wouldn't fly, right? You couldn't have an arbitrator say, well, that's how they defined it. Doesn't comport with the Fair Labor Standards Act, but that's not my business, right? You can't have that.
But again, I think it depends on whether or not ultimately the
well,
agreement in the contract
that work
is
means
reasonable.
The same thing in the CBA as it does in the FLSA?
Your Honor,
I
see that,
you mean that
my time is up. Can I? Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's not.
It's not up, actually. Go ahead.
It's not up.
No escape.
Judge Paul's
no
escape.
It's orange. It hasn't turned red yet.
No, I'm sorry. Your question?
Yeah, don't you have to argue that work means the same thing in the collective bargaining agreement as it does in the Fair Labor Standards Act?
No.
Really?
But then if it's defined in the collective bargaining agreement, as I say, to mean you have to sweat in order to be working, and that would violate the FLSA, then you'd have an arbitrator who was, you know, repealing the FLSA as applied to this group of workers.
I mean, ultimately what you would have there is you would have basically an agreement then, okay, that doesn't comport with the FLSA. Okay, so again, that would be something where you'd be excluding a category of work, if you will, from
right,
ever
exactly.
being compensable.
Yes.
So that doesn't work, but that doesn't mean that the arbitrator can't initially determine what is or what is not work, and that requires interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Montgomery, and thank you to Mr. Steckenberg. So I'll move to our second.